Verse 1, chapter 23 of 1 Samuel, it begins. Now they told David, "Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are robbing the threshing floors." Therefore, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" And the Lord said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah." But David's men said to him, "Behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" And David inquired of the Lord again. And the Lord answered him, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand." And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines and brought away their livestock and struck them with a great blow. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. When Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, had fled to David to Keilah, he had come down with an ephod in his hand. Now it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, and Saul said, "God has given him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars." And Saul summoned all the people to war, to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. And David knew that Saul was plotting harm against him, and he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." And then said David, "O Lord, God of Israel, your servant has surely heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. Will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord of God of Israel, please tell your servant." And the Lord said, "He will come down." And David said, "Will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will surrender you." Then David and his men, who were about 600, rose and departed from Keilah, and they went wherever they could go. When Saul was told that David had escaped from Keilah, he gave up the expedition. And David remained in the strongholds in the wilderness, in the hill country, in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not give him into his hand. David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life. David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, he arose and went to David at Horesh to strengthen his hand in God. And he said to him, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul my father also knows this." And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. Then the Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding among us in the strongholds of Horesh on the hills of Hekalah, which is south of Jeshimon? Now come down, O king, according to all your heart's desire to come down, and your part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand." And Saul said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, for you have had compassion on me. Go, make yet more sure. Know and see the place where his foot is. Who has seen him there? For it is told me that he is very cunning. See, therefore, and take note of the lurking places where he hides, and come back to me with sure information. Then I'll go with you, and if he is in the land, I will search him out among the thousands of Judah." So they rose and went to Ziph instead, or ahead of Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness of Moan, in the Arabah, in the south of Jeshimon, and Saul and his men went to seek him. And David was told, so he went down to the rock and lived near the wilderness of Moan. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Moan. Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men were on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul. As Saul and his men were closing in on David and his men to capture them, a messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid against the land." So Saul returned from pursuing after David and went against the Philistines. Therefore, the place was called the Rock of Escape. And David went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. Obviously, David's life at this point had become pretty crazy. The life that he had known before was gone now. No more was David the star of the show. No more was he the one who was the killer of 10,000s, if you recall the story. The songs and the praises of men were gone. And now, in his new life, he was desperately clinging in survival mode. You know, it is at this point in our lives. And it seems that all of us find ourselves there at some juncture. At this point in our lives that we are truly at the crossroads of our faith. And what we do at this point will mean everything, both to our future as well as the meaning of our past. Will I have a spiritual tomorrow? Or will it effectively come to an end here and now? Will the life I have led, will the road that I have traveled for the past years of my life, will they have any meaning as I move forward? Or will it all be simply flushed away like a dream? Just becoming bitter memories of days gone by? Certainly over nearly 25 years of ministry here, I have witnessed this event, this passing, if you will, occur in many people's lives. Epic moments, if you will, that transformed rising stars into bygone memories. Into spiritual has-beens that are now just today passing mentions in someone else's story. At one time, these people were players. At one time, these people were leaders. But now they are all but forgotten. Just a name that comes up occasionally around campfires when old stories are told. If a person in this role is so determined, I have personally found it is nearly impossible to head off the inevitable collapse. To head off a hell-bent intention. In fact, as I studied for this today, I could not remember ever successfully stepping in to, quote, bring back a sinner from his wandering, end quote, to save his soul from death, to cover a multitude of sins, as James 5:20 says. I cannot, if it happened, it just isn't now being recollected. I cannot remember ever stepping into that kind of a mainline approach by anybody and ever keeping them from their path. I cannot recall ever effectively intervening in such a speeding, careening, out of control trip that was threatening a spiritual oblivion for a person. I can think of a lot of people who went down that road. I'm just saying I can't remember ever stopping anybody from it. The author Gail Forman was once famously quoted as saying, quote, sometimes you make choices in life, and sometimes choices make you. Sometimes you make choices in life, and sometimes choices make you. David, like us today, was at that crossroads. The choices that he would make in this chapter, chapter 23 of 1 Samuel, as well as the next very few chapters that are going to follow 23, will either establish David in the pages of history as a man after the very heart of God, Acts 13:22, or will relegate him just to be a byline in history. This was his crossroads. He chooses wrong and he will be another failure amongst the thousands, just another washout. Now please bear in mind where David is as this is playing out. He's not sitting at home in a lazy boy watching TV, no. He's not having everything's fine. He's not like have a gainfully job and healthy and happily married. No, no. This is a difficult time. David was on the run. David was just trying very hard to survive. Trying to keep his head above the water. I mean, this is not the best time to be a back against the wall kind of scenario. This is not the best time, the most convenient time, if you will, to be pressured to make decisions. And if you've been in a kind of situation like this, you know that you just don't make the best the decisions when you're in this kind of high pressure scenario. And David would now make a couple of critical resolutions, if you will, that would ultimately redeem his standing, that would ultimately forever place him in the hall of faith of Hebrews chapter 11. What made him reach that didn't happen here, but the results of the decisions he made will play out here, and he will therefore be found in that, Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, hall of faith. The gold medal winners, the champions. Frankly, the survivors. Just a couple of decisions. A couple of decisions will be that thin line between legend and oblivion. It's that close. See, I got to tell you, spiritual stardom, if you will, or however you want to spin it, that road is daily and moment by moment just a hair's breadth away from total meltdown. I think we get the idea sometimes that they're so far apart that you just can't see the one for the other. I think it's like a door you pass every day. And there's a sign on the door that says crazy. And every day you walk by and you look at that door. You walk by. The next day you walk by crazy door again. And the next day you walk by crazy door. And occasionally, you kind of crack the door open and look inside. And slowly pull the door shut again. That's how close it is. And every day, you make a decision to go through crazy or whether you keep going. This first decision that David would make here was whether he would be consumed and controlled for the fight for his life. That's the first decision. Will he be consumed by the fight for his life? Would he be so overwhelmed in the battle for self-survival that he will now lose all awareness of a bigger world? He would lose a grasp that there's other people out there, and he would simply sink into a worldview of me and me first. And let me tell you something, gang, that's a small world. A very small world where I am front and center. You see, there is a path at the crossroads. And it's the path of survival. And at the crossroads that David stood that day, he could have washed his hands of everyone else and just simply found a little cabin in the woods, just found a hut on the beach somewhere where he could just rid himself from all the struggle, from all of the strife, and just said, you know what, from now on it's just me. And if you got any years on you at all, you know what I'm telling you is true, don't you? You think about it, don't you? I think about it almost every day. That's the door of crazy in Tim's life. Just move away. Just move away. And on the other way, the other direction on this crossroads was a road where now David, despite all that he had going on, they were trying to kill him. All that he had going on, that road would be a road where he would be required to step up to fight for others. Oh, and not for glory. And not for fame. No more. No. Those, remember? The David, the one who kills the tens of thousands. Those days are gone now. There's no glory in this. There'll be no fame in this. This would be done just for justice and just for right. That's all. David would actually pour himself out for these people. And it is not lost, the fact that is, that eventually these very people that he would pour himself out, risking his life for, would eventually throw him under the bus for their survival. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. There would be no payback. There would be no thanks. There would be no reward. No pat on the back from the people he rescued. Even his own men didn't want to fight. Even his buddies. They were tired. They were afraid. They wanted to hold up because even by their own admission, these tough guys, they were scared. They're like, look, David. Man, aren't things bad enough? Why tempt fate? Why stir up the bees? And isn't that where we all get when we're that situation? We stand there and go, I know what I should do. But man, I'm tired. You know, I mean, it's been hard enough. These people aren't going to back me in the end anyway. Why would I do this? I mean, his guys just wanted to hunker down. They wanted to survive. But you see, for David, survival wasn't enough. Why? Because he wasn't that man. Hear me now, Christian. Simply because he wasn't that kind of man. So he prayed again and he moved against all conventional wisdom. Despite everyone, despite even himself, he would now act according to God's direction. I mean, I love the fact that David, the quintessential man of action, he would here stop to ask God what to do. Twice. What do you want me to do, God? He stopped moving forward, and he prayed. But once he received that direction, he moved. He kept working. He kept serving. He kept helping. He kept obeying. Even in the middle of a storm where he could have said, you know what? Right now, this is all about me. In the middle of all the trials and all the testings, he kept going. Kept obeying and kept others centered. That, I find that incredible. I find that incredibly notable because generally we shut down when we're in that situation. We just go, you know what? No, wait a minute. Until everything in my life is restored, you know, we got to just stop. So we drop out of service. We don't do what we know we're supposed to be doing. And we just hole up on our pew and wait for the world to straighten out. We don't do anything. We just try to survive. Try to survive the battle that we're going through. And it's funny because why is it that when we're there doing that, it never occurs to us, hey, maybe that's exactly what Satan wants. He can't take my soul, so he just wants me to stop. So he'll just keep poking me enough till I go, whoa, I gotta get a grip. And do you understand what you're saying when you say, I have to get a grip? You. Since when have you ever had a grip? If you had a grip, why did Jesus die on the cross? Who needed him? You could have done that then, right? You could save yourself, but you can't save yourself. And the Bible is so bluntly clear when it said, without him, you can do nothing. Nothing. How emphatic. I mean, I read this story and I think this is Daniel in the lion's den. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. Paul in Rome. Joshua in Jericho. You see, these were men who didn't build themselves. These were men who were built by God. And when the rains came in torrents and the floodwaters rose and the winds beat against the house, it did not collapse. The life did not collapse, because that was a life that was literally built upon the rock. Everything. The marriage. The finances. The vocation. The parenting. Everything was a life built on the rock of Jesus Christ. He is my foundation. The people of Keilah, as we've already commented, would fail to reciprocate upon David's service. They, like much of the world, both then and now today, I'm sorry to say, we're only concerned with their own survival and their own comfort. I would imagine that during this time, it did nothing to boost David's faith in humanity. I got to tell you, nothing about ministry will ever boost your faith in humanity. And it mattered little what David would do for them. When the day came, they would kick him to the curb to save their own skin. And yet, David chose door number two. Why would David choose door number two? I mean, would anyone have blamed him if he had chosen the easy road? Would anyone have not forgiven this guy? I mean, come on. I think we all would have went, you know what? The guy has simply had enough. But you see, David didn't choose the easy road. And hear me now. I believe that it was not just because he was strong. I don't believe it was because he was faithful. I don't even believe it was because he was stubborn. I believe it was because he was simply and factually not that man. He was just not the man who could walk away. Because for David, his decisions did not define him, but rather his decisions reflected who and what he already was. Now, for many of us, our decisions are still defining us. When as a Christian, God is drawing us to a point where our decisions simply reflect who we already are. David made decisions of integrity because he was a man of integrity. You see, correct decisions at the crossroads of faith do not come Christian, if they're made at the crossroads. And that's usually when we're making them, don't we? When we're in crisis, when it's all coming down, when it's all hitting the fan, and you're standing there and it's like, look, I have got to make a decision, and you're in the heat of the battle, you're in the passion of the moment, but you know what? Correct decisions are not made there, gang. Correct decisions are of this sort. They are made long before anyone ever gets to that crossroads. Because we will get to that crossroads. Actions here at the crossroads, they happen because of who we are, not who we decide or what we decide to do. That's not what we are to do. It's not what we decide to do. It's who we are. And if we take door number one and we run and hide, it's because that's who you are. If you fold out of pride and stubborn heart, that's because that's who you are. But if you defy all the odds and against all common thinking, you stand in integrity for Christ at the crossroads of faith, it is because that, Christian, is who you really, really are. Because you see, survivors live always in the reality that the crossroads are coming. The testings are inevitable. And if you're living tonight, you're here, and you're living with this fantasy of somehow you're going to dodge that bullet, I'm sorry, nobody dodges that bullet. It will come. Oh, my marriage, it's going to be like Disney. No, it's not. My parenting, I am going to be a star. I'll show the other parents how to do this. No, you won't. It's easy to think that when you're in your 20s. Forgive me, those of you in your 20s. But when you're in your 50s, you've long ago resigned to the reality that a lot happens in this life you don't have any control over. David apparently made the decision which way he would go long before he got here. Long before he came to the crisis, long before he came to the testing. And it seems that from the scriptural account, when he came to that point, he didn't hang around the corner going, No, in fact, we have everything to realize, to believe here. There wasn't even a hesitation. He just stopped, prayed, confirmed, and moved. Why would David go and rescue these people, a people that would not do the same for him? Because he was that kind of man. Now, the second decision that David would make that day, the second choice of roads before him involved control. That's a hot button, isn't it? Because we have a problem with control. I think we in America have more problem than anybody. Because this country gives you the illusion that you can actually be in control. Would he, in the heat of passion, in the heat of pain, grab the reins of his life? Would he grab the bull by the horns and get things under control? Would he take matters into his own hands? After all, you know, at this point in the storyline, I mean, there seemed to be no one to be trusted. No one was on his side. Who or what would have the final word with David? Who would have the final say? Where would the buck stop? And instead of counting on old number one, he repeatedly went to God for direction. Now, please note, Again, things are not rosy. God didn't just give him the winning lottery ticket where it's like, you know what? I feel real good today asking God for counsel. No, and if anybody ever had a reason to go, you know what? I'm going to God, but I don't know why. Where is he? It would be David right here. I mean, he could have been quite naturally overwhelmed with bitterness at this point. I served you, God. I did everything you wanted me to do. My whole life is gone. It just melted down. It's gone. He could have questioned God. He could have blamed God easily for this. I mean, I just, in my mind, I can imagine myself going and saying, you know, what is going on here, God? I thought you said you loved me. I mean, I thought you had my back. I thought you would never fail me. You said you'd never abandon me. But for some reason, that wasn't David's response here. In fact, he prayed and he went to God repeatedly. Now, let us note here, does that mean he was happy about things? No, I don't think he could have been happy about things. Does this mean he had no doubts, no angst about his life and the direction it was going? No, going to God doesn't mean that. But apparently he knew something, and maybe you can relate to me with me tonight, because I've been here many times. Apparently David knew that, frankly, there was simply no place else to go. Back to where? There's nothing back there. He had to know that a break in that ultimate relationship would be his ultimate undoing. He had to know. And frankly, I think he knew it because, again, he just wasn't that man back then. Are you that man? Are you that woman? Is there a price? Because I'm here to tell you tonight that if there's a price to get you to walk, I can prophesy here for you tonight. It's coming. What will it take? Ladies, the right man? What do you think? Gentlemen? You're all just a bunch of stupid men. The right woman? Yeah, you bet. We'll let off. Like a pig with just a ring in his nose there. Big buck job? Would that do it? What would it take to get you kind of compromise this whole Jesus thing? It's awfully expensive anyway. I mean, I'm a Christian. I don't need to do all this. Come on, man. And that crossroads, that decision better have been made long before you get there. Or I will promise you that will be a decision you will lose. And if you are flippant enough to go, no, 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 not me, I'll be okay, then you are the greatest of fools. I would hope that your pastor's years of ministry, what I'm saying to you tonight, would mean something. Because I could fill this church four times over with the dead bodies. And some of them are literally dead. Hebrews 12:1-3 says this: Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down. Not sin. Every weight that slows us down. Especially the sin that is so easily trips us up. Let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. Endurance. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross. He disregarded its shame. And now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. Think of all the hostility he endured from sinful people. Then you won't become weary and give up. So after David's heroic actions there in Keilah, the people, they did not protect him. They did not stand up for him. They did not love him for his sacrifice. In fact, even after what he did, even though his righteous act, even though he stopped running from Saul long enough to go rescue these people, when it was said and done, the enemy just kept coming and David had to keep running. It's like, okay, where was I? Oh, that's right, I'm running. God did not rescue him because he was righteous. God did not take away the problems because he did the right thing over here. Please note that tonight. How often, the truth be told, and it'd be hard-pressed to admit it, but truth be told, how often we act for God, we actually do right because truthfully we do it because we expect reciprocation on the part of God in some manner. We so often do not do it because it's righteous, because it's right, but we figure, you know, if we do this, that God will then get us out of difficulty and testing later on. In other words, God will kind of owe you, right? No, God never owes you. He sent his son to die upon a cross to pay for every sin you ever commit to give you eternal life. He gave you more than you ever could repay him. He doesn't owe you anything. And I got to tell you tonight, if you think that he's coming to somehow owe you because you're doing the right thing, that absolutely isn't true. It isn't a biblical premise. And if we don't get that out of our heads, I promise you, we're headed for a sure crisis of faith. Because you're going to start asking God why. And that's the beginning of the end. Why? Because we live in a fallen world. Why? Because you're a sinner. And just because you're saved doesn't mean you cease to be a screw up. Fact is, King Saul did keep coming. He inexplicably just kept attacking, even though David never did anything to Saul except support him and back him. And I know you stand sometimes and you go, I didn't do anything wrong. How could this be happening to me? Maybe this would explain something David would write later on in his life, where he would look back over his shoulder as that crossroad faded into his memory and he would pen those words, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Because you are with me. Walk through, not around. Walk through. You see, it wasn't that David was particularly smart or clever or daring. It wasn't for these reasons that David survived. He did not win because he was that good. He stayed alive and free because, as verse 14 tells us, God did not allow him to be captured. If you're here tonight, hear me. Do you know why you're still breathing? Because God has kept you breathing. Read the newspaper. People dying all the time, aren't they? Accidents, disease, crazy stuff. Why not you? Because God willed you to be still breathing tonight. And David did all of this not for perceived deserved action, deserved response by God toward him, because God is God. Oh yes, he is David's God, he is our God. And when we follow him, he is with us. What's motivating you tonight, Christian? I asked you recently, would you still be a Christian if there was no heaven? Would you still be a Christian if you didn't do cool stuff for you? If the philosophy was he did indeed put this world in a spin, sent his son, died on a cross, gave you the chance of salvation, and then went home. If that was the case, and it's not, would you still follow him? Would you follow him for what he's done? Or are you following him because of what he's doing? Because what he's doing is never guaranteed. We need to do so because we love our God, because our loyalty compels us. And even if we die, as Daniel 3:16 says, we will not bow to your false gods, O king. Some of the greatest words ever uttered in Scripture. We believe our God's going to save us if you try to throw us in the fiery furnace. But even if he doesn't, we're still not bowing. That's a throwdown. Now, through it all, I believe that Jonathan was a breath of fresh air for David. I mean, he was one man who consistently supported David, and really, it defied all logic that he would, but I think it was Jonathan half the time that kept David from losing his mind. Because Jonathan did what each of us must do for the people in our lives that come to this place. And we all will have people in our lives who will come to this place. And really, it's the only thing we can do for people when they come to this place. And verse 16 says it. It says, Jonathan went to find David and encouraged him to stay strong in his faith with God. See, Christian, that's all I can do for you. You know, just because I'm a pastor, I have no special phone to God. I don't get a little magic wand with the job. I'm just a guy with you, like you, who struggles like you, who has to pray like you, who has doubts like you, who has sins like you, who some days just wants to turn right instead of going straight, just like you. All I can do is tell you to hang tough and stand strong in your faith to God. And to do it now before you come to that crossroads. Now we know that Saul was not the same man he used to be. I mean, we know he at this point was like a lot of people for whom the, quote, Spirit of the Lord had departed, end quote, back in chapter 16. The Spirit of the Lord departed from him.
I don't know. That verse just like it haunts me. It freaks me out. I don't want the Spirit of the Lord to depart from me. Because what happens, and you know it biblically true and you know it practically true, that when the Spirit departs from our lives, a vacuum is created that will start to pull in all sorts of things around us. When we push away that Spirit of the Lord and He departs, all of a sudden that vacuum starts sucking up bitterness and anger and jealousy, violence. As we covered in the last two chapters, we know that Saul would find himself in those chapters and onward doing things that earlier in his life would have been absolutely unthinkable. That he would do things and he would turn to things and he would act in such ways that at one point in his life it's like, no way, that will never happen in my life. But it did, didn't it? And how many of us have been in those same shoes? Only look and go, I don't know how in the world I got myself into this. You see, these are the choices that make you. We made choices and they made you. I know some people out there today that, oh God, they're wicked. They have done things and said things, foul, terrible things. And I have shared communion with them. I have walked in God's house with them. And when I did, I imagine any even suggestion that they would be where they are today would have been unthinkable. And again, if you can look at that and go, oh no, but not me, I would be careful. Be careful, Christian. When Jonathan came to David here, in verse 16, this would be the final time that they would ever talk. Do you think about that when you're with the people that you love? We just say goodbye, see you later, right? How do you know that's not the last time you'll ever see that person alive? Would we not live our lives so much differently if we held that in the palm of our hands every day? In an incredible display of strength here, integrity on Jonathan's part, he swears allegiance to David again, and he does so even over his own father. Wow. That's a lot. And then he says something in verse 17, I think that we could skip right over if we weren't looking at this. He says, I know that you are the chosen one, David. And furthermore, he says, and my father knows it too. Saul? Yeah, Saul knows it too. You see, Saul knew that he, David, was the chosen one. He knew that God would not be deterred, and yet he still incredulously would not stand down. He still would not surrender. And you look at that and you go, what are you thinking, man? And I think that what he was thinking, by opinion only, I think he was thinking that if he surrendered, it would be to David. When the truth would be told, his surrender would be to God. To God, because God was the one running the show, not David.
And so his pride kept him from it. Saul, like so many of us who are tonight fighting against God, he verbalized and executed his wrath against a man when his battle was really against God. Saul was angry at God, and Saul was going to kill David because he was angry at God. Where's mine, God? You told me, how come I don't, he's God, but I, oh. But we can't really reach out and punch God in the nose, can we? So we go after whoever's available, spouse, family, friends, strangers. I wonder how many of us tonight are fighting a battle like that. Certainly I know there are plenty of people tonight chasing me that aren't really mad at me as much as they're mad at God. I mean, they're mad that God told them no about something. We're not very good at receiving that, are we? Or mad because God called me to the pastorate and not them. Where's my church? I don't know. Mad because God wouldn't support them in something they wanted to do, and I wouldn't either. So they couldn't blast God because that'd look bad, so they spent years blasting me. Thy protesteth too much, methinks, as Shakespeare said. Jonathan knew this. Saul knew it too, but he wasn't talking. In the end of this story today, the suspense builds as the chapter's coming to a close, as it seems kind of that David and his boys are going to be captured. It's like a TV show. But God intervened. Again, just like with us, God intervenes again and again and again. And here we are tonight, still breathing. We're still here. God has intervened how many times, you figure, to let you sit here? Maybe it's time to set down the bitterness and the anger and the problems that we have with the people around us, and maybe even the God that's really ruling our lives, and realize that God has intervened again and again and again, and God's got your back. God has not promised to take you away from the valley of the shadow of death. He hasn't even promised to walk you around it, but he will walk you straight through it. That's the God that we follow. But please note, when he does, he promises to walk through it with you. I have this card. I've had it for years. My wife bought it for me, I think, sometime for my anniversary. It's a big thing between her and I and our marriage. But there's this little thing where Piglet is with Pooh. And he reaches up and touches Pooh, and Pooh goes, "Oh, what is it, Piglet?" He goes, "Nothing. I just wanted to be sure of you." It's okay. I think if you reach out and just tell God, I just wanted to be sure of you. He's there. There will be no walking around the valley of the shadow of death. This is a straight through journey, because God's people don't go around. Not when you got God beside you. When you come out the other side, will you remember?
will you worship? Will you remember all of the past journeys when you come to the crossroads again? Did you this time? What kind of person are you? That's how you will respond. What decisions have you made in your life? That's the decisions you will make. If you're a committed person, you will be committed. If you are a wishy-washy person, you will wishy-wash. And one day when you walk past that door, you'll open it up, step through, shut the door behind you, and we will not see you again. And if you believe that you are exempt from this, then the devil has got you, and you're the biggest fool of all. Let's stand.